JSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, we've all heard it before, eat less meat. People lucky enough to eat should eat less of everything.
When you look at the consumption of protein that human beings eat in the developed world, and for that matter in many transition economies, in other words, a large part of the world now, we eat significantly more protein than we need to repair our tissues for growing, for growth in children, and even for active adults who are using a lot of energy and a lot of muscle power and so on.
Microbe magic. Having fun with microbes. Growing them.
Oh, this one's much nicer. See? You see, really clearly see the purple, purpley-orange patches of sulfur bacteria and the green patches of green sulfur bacteria.
And these are things something that little kids could do.
Yeah. It's not toxic and not dangerous because these are environmental bacteria, so they're not going to harm you.
And Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Israel's eternal undivided capital for Jewish Israelis, not for indigenous Palestinians.
Israel demolishes 250 apartments a year, so some that have multiple families, but Israel doesn't touch the building in which the settlers live. And we heard of multiple cases that Palestinians in the neighborhood are attacked.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. Before launching in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. I'm David Kattenberg. We have heard it before. To avoid impending Earth crisis, if it isn't too late, people need to change their eating habits. Those who have the choice should opt to eat food grown or raised close to home. Unpackaged, unprocessed foods contain less embodied carbon, and experts say eat less meat. Takes lots of energy to grow meat. Livestock production generates lots of CO2 and methane and leaks nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus into the environment. Aside from all this, people who get to eat probably eat too much. So says Alan Buckwell, a British agricultural economist, turning to a concept associated with Swedish earth scientist Stefan Rockström. Buckwell co-authored a paper entitled, What is the Safe Operating Space for EU Livestock? I spoke with Alan Buckwell about food consumption.
The proposition that we're over-consuming and we're over-consuming livestock is one that I now feel confident in saying I accept that. There's plenty of, I can point to the evidence that supports that statement. And there's no doubt there's massive damage arises from it. I mean, of course, the destruction of habitat isn't just for food production. It's for timber production and it's for infrastructure and development. And of course, it's been going on since economic development's been going on. It's been going on for centuries. And in a sense, in the temperate parts of the world, we destroyed a large part of our forest quite a long time ago. We certainly did in Europe. And so we're now seeing other countries catching up, so to speak. But it's not doing the world any good. And the climate threat, in my view, the biggest threats are the greenhouse gases, the climate threat, the loss of biodiversity, and the oversupply of nutrients into the environment, particularly into water.
This is what you refer to as leakage.
Leakage, exactly. And this is the fundamental problem of livestock, is they're very leaky. When you feed essential nutrients, nitrogen and potassium, that's the basis of all protein and all life, that when you look at the kilograms, we now have assessments of the flows of those elements in Europe. I don't know whether you've done it for North America. That when you look at the tons of nitrogen and phosphorus applied to agricultural land, how much is taken up by crops? Of that, how much is eaten by animals? Of that, how much is retained by the animals to maintain their own bodily functions and their own bodily structures? And how much of the crops and the animals eaten by human beings is used for their own bodily functions? And then how much isn't? And the answer is, it's sort of 70 or 80% of the nutrients that get into the system that leak back into the environment in one form or another. And when they do, they mostly do it in a way which cumulatively causes damage. The nitrogen gets out there in the form of nitrogen oxide and particulates, and it causes either greenhouse gas problems or ammonia, and it either causes greenhouse gas problems or human respiratory problems, but either way it's not very helpful. And the phosphorus is and the nitrogen are leading to eutrophication of rivers, lakes and oceans. And the problem is that when we do this year in, year out, decade in, decade out, for a steadily growing population, then we get out of balance. And that's what we're saying. We are out of balance.
And it's astonishing that human beings, humanity has deposited more, has more than doubled the amount of reactive nitrogen and phosphorus on the landscape since pre-industrial. It's a vast, vast amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that humans have put into the system.
Yep. Yes, exactly, and as I say, that and it's harmful because it's reactive nitrogen, not this sort of unreactive nitrogen gas that makes up most of the atmosphere, and it turns out it's damaging, and so we have to limit it. And I do want to come to the other side, because we're focusing on the negative aspects of agriculture, and particularly livestock agriculture, and livestock are leaky because they're rather inefficient users of these things. Chickens are better than pigs, and pigs are better than cattle, and cattle are the worst of all in terms of pollution and leakage. But there's a positive story to tell. But let me just say one other factor that I found it was a heavy realization when it dawned on me, was that when you look at the consumption of protein that human beings eat in the developed world, and for that matter in many transition economies, in other words a large part of the world now, we eat significantly more protein than we need to repair our tissues for growth in children, and even for active adults who are using a lot of energy and a lot of muscle power and so on. We consume a lot more protein than our bodies require. What happens to the surplus protein that we consume? And the answer is it's simply burned for energy, and it's a less efficient process creating your energy from protein, because it has to be deaminated and turned into material that can be then burned in the cells for energy. This is a very inefficient way of supplying human beings with energy. They could have just as well got that energy from carbohydrates.
But there are other sources of protein beside meat. We can get our protein from other sources. Perhaps meat as a source of protein is less efficient, or places us outside that safe operating space vis-a-vis other sources of protein. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, exactly so. That's exactly the point, that because livestock production, animal production, is inefficient and leaky, therefore there are plenty of other sources of protein, plant protein, pulses and so on, that are less leaky, less damaging to the environment. But we should be consuming, our conclusion is that we're over consuming livestock products, especially meat. That's what should be cut down. But we're over-consuming proteins generally, although most of the excess, in a sense, is livestock products. But we're over-consuming calories too. I mean, that's another problem, is that we're simply consuming too much food for our own good, and certainly for the planet's good. And so there's a difficult story there, that we should be consuming less in total and higher quality. And therefore avoid a significant part of the environmental damage that we're now creating. But let me just mention the positive sides of livestock, because it's to me a European landscape, and you can speak for yourselves in North America. A European landscape without animals would be unacceptable to most Europeans.
And it's sort of the image of Europe. It's that bucolic image of cows sheep grazing on fields. It's iconic.
Exactly, and relatively small fields, because they in themselves have created the animals and the field management that's used to support livestock production, or can be used to support livestock production, create the kind of cultural landscape that Europeans want. And the places where Europeans go on their holidays is either to the coast or they go into the countryside. And they don't go to the arable areas or the horticultural areas. They go to the pastoral areas. They're often in the uplands, but they can also be on lowlands, marshlands, and so on. These are the landscapes that people enjoy. And they're associated with livestock production. So there's what we wanted to do was to try and shift the debate to make some to get some traction on some of these issues, because they're being talked about for a very long time and nothing much was happening, by, in a sense, trying to find another concept to get people to focus attention. And that's where we focused on safe operating space. And the notion is that the negatives define the upper limits to that space. The positive contributions of livestock to pasture utilization, and also in providing high quality, enjoyable protein, these should lead us to be able to calculate a lower limits to the safe operating space. And what we find in the quantification, which is very preliminary that we've done so far, is that Europe, of course, is not in its space. It's way in excess of the upper limits, and we don't need anything like the number of livestock to supply the lower limits.
I want to get to some of the solutions that you're proposing in your report, but you've spoken about nutrient leakage, the amount of nutrients, volume of nutrients that need to be applied to landscapes in order to support livestock production, and all the leakage. But how about energy inputs and associated greenhouse gas emissions? Like, we've all heard about the energy intensity of associated with raising a cow versus raising, I don't know, a hectare of wheat, and it's more energy intensive to produce meat. Can you comment on that?
It's interesting you say that, David, because that's not a metric and it's not a dimension that you're the first person in the year and a half since we've been doing this study who's drawn attention to that. That we, in a sense, the energy that I think we're making the same argument, but indirectly, that for us, given the intensity of European agriculture and the fact that Europe is importing a huge amount of nutrient, both in terms of feed for pigs, dairy cows and chickens, and we're manufacturing a massive amount of fertilizer, which we're adding to the system. It's the nutrient intensity and then the associated leakage of either ammonia, which is a air pollutant, or greenhouse gases, methane, nitrous oxide. The focus is on that rather than energy consumption by the animals. But of course, if you're making the argument that animals are utilizing protein and nitrogen and phosphorus inefficiently, well, then, you know, I would say the argument will obviously carry forward. You're using energy inefficiently too. It's better for, I mean, that was the point I was making a few moments ago. To the extent that human beings are over-consuming animal products and then simply burning them for energy, it would have been much more efficient for them to have consumed vegetable material, crops, cereals, vegetables, and so on, derive their energy from that directly, because it cuts out the inefficiency of animals. Because we know how many kilograms of feed it takes to get a kilogram of chicken, which is a smaller number than the equivalent number for pigs, which is smaller than the equivalent number for livestock. They are inefficient ways of converting energy and vital nutrients, and it's the combination of the inefficiency and the leakage and the fact that we're over-consuming, that makes a devastating mix, which says that humankind, you haven't always eaten the rate we currently have. It's interesting that these over-consumption trends are something that's come on in the last four or five decades. and they come with economic development and the relative cheapening of food and the massive increase in the variety of foods that people can have access to in 24 hours a day, that we simply eat too much, and it's not doing us any good. It's not doing the climate any good.
Let's talk about some of the solutions. How do we move food production, livestock production, back into a safe operating space?
Our view, and I don't know how this argument sounds in your part of the world, but our view is that we've got to persuade our top-level politicians that this is an issue that they have to talk about, because they don't. It's regarded as too difficult, too complicated, and not of sufficient importance given all the other hugely important strategic issues that we've got to deal with. But in our view, that I think we've persuaded the public they have to decarbonize energy. We have to run with the same story, except you've got to consume less livestock products. We're not asking people to become vegans or vegetarians because we want some minimal level of livestock, for all the reasons I've said. That I think that human beings are, there's plenty of room for diversity in eating cultures and so on. But the critical thing is that the bulk of us who are simply consuming more than is good for us and is good for the environment, the more we can hear it being said and repeated at the highest level, that is the case, rather than these periodic reports from NGOs, which I think those people are doing an important service in society by drawing attention to this, but they don't always carry that much weight. And so that's our first thing, is to get this reviewed at a higher level. Because in Europe, we have a very big and quite expensive apparatus for supporting agriculture, and we're simply saying it's not good enough, that it doesn't, it's not honest enough in reflecting that agriculture's got to make a larger transition than the politicians are suggesting. The farmers don't want to hear that. They're struggling to make the changes they're already being told about. But I think we have to face this.
What should replace, or what can replace, livestock production?
Well, we see our first point is, I mean, to be blunt, nothing. Just eat less. Eat less protein and less livestock protein. But of course, people should go for a balanced diet. We're not saying exclude livestock. We're saying reduce it. Let's say 40-50% have many more livestock-free, or particularly meat-free meals per week, and that would do the trick, and have less meat when you have it.
But you speak in your report about novel foods, and I think amongst the most novel foods are crickets. People talk about cricket production these days as an alternative, much more sustainable source of protein.
Yeah, these are all are being looked at. We absolutely encourage they should be looked at. Insect protein, algal protein, nuts, pulses, the plant-based protein, and these novel sources, even cultured meat. As far as I'm concerned, there isn't one solution that can, I think, make a rather small contribution. But I think also we can be finding different protein sources to feed our animals on, and that can certainly include insect protein, and that's beginning to scale up. But those alternative protein sources, I think they're interesting, but I think they've got a long way to go before they can be scaled up to significantly displace the existing sources of protein, of soya in particular. You're talking about requiring tens of millions of tons, and at the moment those sorts of production systems are dealing with handfuls of tons, not even hundreds or thousands. It's got a long way to go, and we don't know what the challenges are of large-scale insect production. You know, what about containment? What diseases will they suffer from? What substrates are they feeding on? And what are the facilities when they get scaled up like to live next door to? That we've got a long way to go to discover the answer to those questions. But of course, it's good that people are looking at them. I think that more of the solution is already in known technologies, that you can have a perfectly good diet by having less meat and more nuts, pulses, and other existing proteins. I mean, we're seeing a lot more veggie burgers. You could have a delicious burger that you know, with the skills that we now have in finding flavors and preparing foods, that you don't have to have a burger that's based on 100% meat.
Emeritus Professor Alan Buckwell taught agricultural economics at Newcastle University and Y College in the UK. He was policy director of the Country Land and Business Association and is currently senior research fellow at the Institute for European Environmental Policy. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, please go to greenplanetmonitor.net and subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep dishing up Earth voices and stories to listen to, read, and watch. Mention the word bacteria. Some people recoil in horror. Truth be told, most prokaryotes are perfectly harmless and even helpful. Better yet, bugs are fun to grow, observe, play with, and harness for useful purposes outside and inside your body. Listen to this. These are very complicated structures you've got.
Yeah, they're called reactors, so we call them chemostats or bioreactors. And we grow our bacteria continuously.
In a crowded lab at Radboud University in the Dutch city of Nijmegen, Marjan Smolders grows bacteria that thrive in soil and water, not in people.
And then we'll go to the Winogradsky column, which is in the controlled temperature room.
Down the hall, Smolders shows me how to grow environmental bacteria on your kitchen sill for fun.
So these are Winogradsky columns. These are the ones the students made.
And it's just in a soft drink bottle.
Yeah, in a 500ml bottle.
Sergei Winogradsky, renowned Ukrainian microbiologist. In the early 20th century, he grew bacteria in glass columns, the kinds that cycle carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur in soil and water. So this looks like something that people could do at home.
Oh yeah, definitely, yeah.
Winogradsky columns are easy to set up. Pour a cup of pond sediment into a clear plastic or glass bottle. Add a square of toilet paper, a teaspoon of Epsom salt, a bit of egg, some eggshell, and a rusty nail. Top up with more pond water, close the bottle, leave it on a sunny sill, and wait.
Oh, this one's much nicer. See? You see, really clearly see the purpley-orange patches of sulfur bacteria and the green patches of green sulfur bacteria.
And these are things, something that little kids could do.
Yeah. It's not toxic and not dangerous because these are environmental bacteria, so they're not going to harm you.
Winogradsky columns are safe, but you don't want to taste their magic. Sauerkraut is another story. Anna Sigrether studies fermentation culture at Concordia University and creates her own ferments. Sauerkraut is easy, she says.
So you just shred up your cabbage, basically. You add a certain amount of salt by weight. And in that salty cabbage juice, that becomes the environment in which these lactobacilli, which exist on the surface of the cabbage already, can start to grow and proliferate. There's a bacteria called Leuconostoc. Those bacteria can come in and generate some of the more like tasty flavors before the just lactobacillus just comes in and just rips that pH right down.
For Anna Sigrether, bacterial ferments are more than just tasty.
Honestly, you know, it's quite romantic in the 19th century sense of the term, you know, the idea of the sublime nature, the something that's kind of at once beautiful and awe-inspiring.
Often people say we are what we eat, but I think we are what our gut microbes do with what we eat.
For Janelle Healy, awesome stuff happens down in our gut, and we can join in. Healy is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of British Columbia and a registered dietitian.
A westernized diet is generally considered to not be helping our gut microbes thrive. And so having more plant-based diets, a Mediterranean diet, diets that are variable with a mix of different food groups, seems to be more beneficial to our microbes because it allows us to feed them with the substrates that they need.
Gut microbes enjoy fermentable oligosaccharides, a common component of bananas, onions, leeks, garlic, asparagus, artichokes, and whole grains. They also like fresh fruit, berries, and nuts. But feel free to experiment, says Healy.
We're a little petri dish where we can kind of experiment with ourselves and our diet. Yeah, if you feed them well, they will look after you.
Then there's the experiment on your windowsill.
These, for example, are cyanobacteria.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, that's spirulina. You can eat this. Spirulina platensis. Really healthy, and they've got lots of very good omega-3 fatty acids.
According to recent research, spirulina also reduces oxidative stress and inflammation in athletes and may be useful in the treatment of diabetes. How it works is not clear. Microbe magic.
Yes, it is. They're really cool. They're beautiful. Yeah, clever bacteria.
For details on how to set up your own Vinogradsky column or Winogradsky column, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. And while you're there, subscribe. For $5 or more, hugely grateful. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Gotta say it twice, the so-called eternal undivided capital of what a growing number of credible observers call an apartheid state. Under the 2002 Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, apartheid is defined as, quote, an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over any other racial group or groups, and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime, unquote. In search of Israeli apartheid, go no further than East Jerusalem, home to 362,000 indigenous Palestinians and 234,000 Jewish settlers transferred into East Jerusalem across the Green Line beyond Israel's legal borders in flagrant breach of international law. East Jerusalem's Jewish settlers get all the breaks. The Palestinians get surveilled, humiliated, harassed, attacked, arrested, shot, no questions asked. Their homes get confiscated or bulldozed. Israel's aim? To get rid of them, thereby boosting Jewish demographics. I toured East Jerusalem with a chap named Shai Goren. Goren is a teacher and tour guide with the progressive Israeli group Ir Amin.
So on these tours, I'll say we go from Gilo, from the, you know, most southern end of Jerusalem, overlooking Bethlehem and Beit Jala, and we start shifting around the city towards north, and then we end in the areas of the separation wall around Shoifat refugee camp and Kufar Aqab. So that gives, I think, a good understanding of how was Jerusalem built to begin with, why was the annexation done the way it was, and how that leads to things happening right now.
The government of Israel talks about Jerusalem as being the eternal, undivided capital of the state of Israel. But Jerusalem today, geographically speaking, is much, much bigger. The boundaries of Jerusalem, as they have been established progressively since 1967, are much bigger than what Jerusalem was at the time of David.
Huge difference. I mean, Jerusalem's old city, which many people will say that's, you know, the classic Jerusalem for 4,000 years, it's a very small city of 1 square kilometer. And then, okay, at one point, Jerusalem comes out of the city walls. It's happening around 1860. And there are a couple of very famous Jewish neighborhoods and Palestinian neighborhoods to leave the city walls. And you see kind of a very nice urban flow of development in the town. So Jews build Mishkenot Sha'ananim, and the Palestinians build Baba Zara and Sheikh Jarrah, which, you know, becomes very famous in the last couple of years. But the city yet is not very big. It's a couple of square kilometers in it. What happens in the division